Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Ringtone or not, there's the music for the Brian Lehrer Show. And every year, the Eurasia Group, a global political risk research and consulting firm, releases a list of the top 10 global political risks to business. In years past, they focused on specific political events, an election or a military conflict, for example, or just big government after the 2008 meltdown. This year, however, the focus of their list has a macro geopolitical lens. And before your eyes glaze over, the question is the biggest business risk in 2011 a fundamental change in the world order? Ian Bremmer, the president of Eurasia Group, joins us to talk risk assessment and run down what he sees as the ways the global business environment is changing and intersecting with geopolitics. Ian, welcome back to WNYC.
Good morning. Always good to be with you.
For starters, tell us a little bit about this list. You're identifying the risks to business around the world. Remind our listeners, do you mean this as an investment guide, a strategic asset? What?
We mean this as a way to look at the world for people that are thinking about how the global economy actually works. And that can be a big investor. It can be a corporate executive. It can be someone with a pension. It's basically anyone that's impacted by the global economy. That's the way we think about it.
So we've heard G8 and the G20, the summits, the groups where powerful nations try and agree on how the international world could be organized. You have a concept here, the G0.
The G0, and that's a pretty meaty concept. What we're thinking is that over the course of the last couple years post-financial crisis, there's been a real sense of panic on the part of all of the world's countries that, you know, the financial architecture is under threat, and so people need to take it seriously. This is the year we are coming out of the financial crisis. The U.S. economy is doing better. Emerging markets are performing like Topsy. But it's also a year where there's really no governance going forward. The Americans engage in quantitative easing, throw hundreds of billions of dollars at the balance sheet. The Chinese don't move on their currency despite the fact that we push them. And other countries say, well, we're just going to have to take it all in our own hands. And so, you know, we see claims of a currency war, claims of a trade war, but what we don't see is anyone at the international level saying, let's all get this together and coordinate. And that concerns a lot of folks, and it's one of the reasons why so many dollars, trillions of dollars for corporations still sit on the sidelines.
So if your risk number one 2 years ago, and we had that conversation at the time, was a strong hand of government around the world in response to the 2008 financial collapse, then your number one risk right now is anarchy, in a sense, or not enough government?
Oh, there's going to be a lot of government. There's no question about that. But that doesn't mean that government's going to be coordinated. When you think about the fact that you have, you know, sort of mounting problems on climate, but none of these countries are prepared to actually sit down together and say, here's what we need to do in coordinated fashion. There's lots of concerns about how to get the global economy going. But it's not about let's have new trade agreements. It's about let's focus on our own domestic constituencies, our own domestic economics. And in a globalized world, over the last 40 years, multinational corporations becoming increasingly dominant economic actors, that's created a lot of productivity. We're going to see a large amount of economic growth over the next year, but most of it, the vast majority, is coming from emerging markets, and those are countries that not only are less stable, but they're less willing to play a global leadership role.
And number two, therefore, on your list is Europe, just Europe as a risk factor. Is all of Europe existentially a business risk?
Well, we do get into it, as I think you know. So, I mean, we spend a lot of time. It's Europe itself is not going to fall apart. The Eurozone is really not in existential crisis. But the ability of the peripheral European states, so I'm talking about Ireland, Greece, Portugal, Spain, third largest economy in Europe, the ability of those governments to maintain the level of austerity that they've committed to, over the next 12 months is really limited. And when they start to slip because of domestic instability, because of opposition politics, because of entrenched organizations like trade unions that say enough is enough, at that point, the French and the Germans, who have been putting a lot of money, a lot of taxpayer money sort of throwing them at these countries to ensure that they have the ability to continue to pay their bills, that's going to get a lot messier. So you're going to see restructurings, and you have the potential to see contagion as some of these economies get themselves into a lot of trouble.
Ian Bremmer, my guest on WNYC, president of the Eurasia Group, with his annual list of the top 10 global political risks to business. We've talked a lot on this show about cybersecurity and privacy of information, whether it's WikiLeaks or corporate or whatever. Do you think 2011 is the year that hackers move from being a potential threat to really damaging businesses?
Well, I think that is the single biggest known unknown globally this year, especially when you think about the global economy. I think it's pretty clear that Julian Assange, the founder and head of WikiLeaks, is going to go down this year, whether legally or through extra-legal means. And he will become the first cyber martyr on the global stage. That means that there will be, you know, sort of like-minded folks, info-anarchists, that are going to try to cause some damage, and the question will be just how much damage that's going to be.
What did you mean he might go down by extra-legal means?
Well, I mean, he's talked himself about sort of the notion of being, you know, sort of rendition and the rest. I mean, you know, could he be assassinated? There are clearly lots of threats against him. It's not clear in what ways he and his site are going to be brought low, but the number of international enemies he has, both in terms of the U.S. government and the various arms of the U.S. government, but also lots and lots of other folks, both legal and shadowy, he's not someone that I'd want to be betting on in terms of having a long public shelf life going forward.
So it's the political hackers, like the group Anonymous, that you see as a reaction to Julian Assange going down that becomes the risk to business?
That's one risk, and it's a significant one, especially because the willingness of those organizations actually, you know, go after both governments as well as corporations that are seen to supporting governments and helping to limit what WikiLeaks can do will probably be much more substantial in the next year than we've ever seen before. They clearly have capacity. But the other thing that's interesting is that the global political environment is increasingly about economic security and not about conventional military or nuclear security. And as states become more important economic actors, the states and their proxies, their willingness to use things like cyber to engage in industrial espionage and get themselves advantages for their own economic position, that's growing as well. And so Western corporations are clearly going to be exposed as a consequence of that.
Do you think that cybersecurity has the potential to destabilize relationships between countries? We hear every so often about Chinese attacks on the American government's online presence or whatever.
Well, I think it does, and part of the reason it does is because there really isn't any form of virtual commons. There's no set of rules of engagement on the cyber side. I mean, we know that if the Chinese were to have a bomber, a military bomber that would buzz through American airspace, that would be a crisis. It's a no-go area. The Chinese wouldn't do it. The Americans wouldn't tolerate it. But on the cyber side, we have the ability for governments to effectively go to economic war against other countries like the U.S. or its allies likely did with the Stuxnet attacks against the Iranian uranium enrichment complex over the course of the last year. And yet, first of all, there's no way to be certain of who the initial actor actually is. And secondly, we don't have any sort of agreement on what is absolutely beyond the pale. And I suspect we won't get there until we've had a few of those test cases.
Ian Bremmer, president of the Eurasia Group, with his annual list of global political risks to business and world economies, his 1 through 10 list, and U.S. political gridlock makes the list, coming in at number 7. Do you see the risk here as being simply that Obama won't make good on his pro-business U.S. Business kind of policy promises, or does it go beyond that?
I think that's a part of it, of course. I also think the willingness of both Republicans and Democrats in Congress to push political issues that they really have no intention of actually moving forward for. It's, for example, Obama on immigration, the DREAM Act, likely that they're going to talk about that a fair amount over the course of the year. But there's no way that's going to get through the Republican-dominated Congress. I see the Republicans doing the same on their side. So gridlock is going to be a problem, I think, from a market perspective. But again, down at number seven, around things like Mexico and Pakistan, the U.S. is the world's largest economy. Anything the U.S. does should have outsized impact. So this, frankly, isn't a very big year for American risk if we look over the next 12 months.
And when you rank these 1 to 10, does that come with a prescription on how to help mitigate these risks, given that you've changed the list to encompass such sweeping big picture items as we've been discussing? Is there anything specific that businesses or, you know, mom and pop investors with pensions or anyone else can do to respond to the list?
Well, knowing that what the risks are certainly helps you. I mean, I think that what's so interesting is that in an environment of enormous global uncertainty, I think much more volatility, uncertainty in the next year than we've seen for a very long time, the typical response is, let's go into gold, let's keep our money on the sidelines, let's not take very significant new bets. And I think our view has always been that a strong understanding of what the risks and opportunities are globally means that you can be much more of a first mover and take advantage of some of the opportunities and limit the exposure to the risk. So it's really a question of where you're going to think about your personal investments, your corporate investments.
Well, that's always what investors try to do. But for this year, do you recommend then a lot of money into emerging markets to invest in China and India and Brazil and like that?
So for example, I think this is clearly going to be a very strong year for a lot of emerging markets. But unlike last year, where there was just a wall of money that went in emerging markets across the board in almost undifferentiated fashion because everything else seemed to be so scary, with the U.S. economy starting to pick up, emerging markets as an asset class will be much more differentiated this year. And so as a consequence, you wouldn't want to just go into an emerging market fund. You'd really want to pick and choose. There are some emerging markets that will underperform, and they're going to get really, really hit in this environment. Countries like Hungary, for example, which has just taken over the presidency of the EU and has major fiscal problems and won't get a clean bailout from the IMF. Argentina and Peru, with elections coming up that markets think are going to be okay, but probably are going to be very problematic from an investment perspective.
And what about China? Isn't that on your list of risks in some way? And some people say China, for all the growth that's real, is in a bit of a bubble.
China, I think, is absolutely not in a near-term bubble. One of the things about the state capitalist system in China is that, you know, sort of you basically get much more certain near to medium-term growth at the expense of perhaps the biggest bubble the world has ever seen. China will be in trouble when they start running out of cheap labor, the way the Argentinians ran out of cheap land and the Venezuelans ran out of cheap oil. But they're not running out of cheap labor anytime soon. Hundreds and hundreds of millions of folks still moving into urban centers throughout that country, and with very, very productive and cheap rates. The story over the course of the next couple of years will be that China will outperform market expectations. They'll outgrow what people think they can do, and they won't budge enough to Western pressure. That's going to lead to confrontation internationally, but shouldn't be slowing down Chinese growth.
Ian Bremmer, president of the Eurasia Group, with his annual list of the top 10 global political risks to economies and business. They will be webcasting their event around this, which is called Top Risks and Ethical Decisions 2011. That's January 19th, next Wednesday, about 12:20, at a certain website.
EurasiaGroup.net, you can certainly check out, and also you can look at the Carnegie Institute for Ethics and International Affairs.
Thank you very much.